years ago they came out and said profiling was illegal. So you're looking for, I've heard law enforcement officers now talk about indicators.
I hate the word profiling because it always gets lumped into racial profiling. But cops are always profiling, but they're looking for the criminal profiling aspect of it. It doesn't matter your race, religion, sex, any of that stuff. None of that matters. Cops that are out there doing the job the right way for the right reasons are trained to go find criminals. That's what you want them to do. That's what society pays cops to do. You just don't want us sitting around doing nothing and then you call us. You want us proactively finding criminals. So in order to do that, you have to understand the psychology and, you know, get the training and understanding of what a criminal is and what a criminal does.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to episode 2 of this week's edition of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. We got Mr. Kenny Williams here, 18-year law enforcement veteran from Northwest Indiana, a suburb of Chicago, Illinois, where they have no crime whatsoever because Kenny's up there. Yeah, if you believe that. Believe that, I got a bridge down here in Florida for sale. Okay. But we spent yesterday just talking about Kenny's career, talking about canines and you know, his background and everything. But what we want to cover today is to get into actual cases that he's been involved with. I love bringing canine officers on here. I just find it so interesting. And you know, having worked with canine officers in the field, that I never had a canine, but watching their capabilities, how intelligent these dogs are, how willing they are to sacrifice their own lives for their handler. It's just amazing. So if you remember from yesterday, we did mention a former police officer who was killed in the line of duty, Robbie Bishop, who worked for the Villa Rica, Georgia Police Department as an interdiction officer. When I was stationed in Atlanta, he was one of the officers out there running interdiction on the west side towards the Alabama state line. Just one of the most aggressive, one of the most successful interdiction officers, just had a nose for the work. I don't think there's anything in the world he was afraid of. And so we've dedicated this week's episodes to Robbie Bishop. And I lost his end of watch date here. It was January 20th, 1999. So brother, Robbie, rest in peace, man. And thank you for your service. So Kenny, back to business here. We've learned now that Gibby's the dog that's doing everything, but you also had, what was your, Mojo? What was your
Mojo. Mojo.
Oh, was it Mojo?
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to make a joke there. Hey, I actually remembered something. That's unusual for Murph. But I'm just interested in some of the things that your dog did, because we know it's not a people search dog, it's a drug search dog, but all the other things that dogs do, this one is pretty much straight outright sniff narcotics. First of all, what narcotics could your dogs find for us?
The first one was any like heroin derivative, cocaine derivative, meth derivative. So basically like crack, because there's cocaine derivative, opiate based type stuff. Mojo could also find marijuana, THC, anything along those lines. Gibby, even though my state marijuana is still 100% illegal, we did not put marijuana on Gibby. We were just kind of worried about the changing of times and worried about, I honestly didn't want to have to train another dog. So if the state said, yeah, marijuana is, you know, recreation or illegal now, like that's going to have implications throughout the state. So we just never put Gibby on marijuana itself.
What about fentanyl?
So fentanyl, we don't put our dogs on fentanyl just because of the process. I know people are going to say different things, but it can be dangerous. I know Canada is a great thing. Also, we've had attorneys come in and look at it, and theoretically, fentanyl can be a legal substance that you can have. Mm-hmm. There's no case law that I'm aware of to support whether dogs allergic to fentanyl are being questioned or not. So we kind of, it's kind of an unknown. So we haven't. That doesn't mean that if they're not cutting it with heroin or something along those lines, that the dog wouldn't alert to it, or the way that they're processing or packaging or touching other drugs. Like there's still a possibility that the dog alert, but we don't necessarily imprint our dogs on fentanyl.
All right. I'm surprised to hear that. But I do know fentanyl is a legal substance, because I had my knee replaced, my left knee replaced a couple of years ago. And before they took you in, I asked the nurse that was there, they had a male nurse there. He was real cut up. He was very funny. And I asked him what they were going to give me to knock me out. And he said, well, fentanyl and then something else. And I'm like, dude, do you have a Narcan kit? He's like, don't worry. It's on the tray here just in case. He said, but it's just such a small dose. He said the chances of you overdosing are almost non-existent. So it does have a legitimate purpose. But the crap that's coming in from Mexico is not. That's not made under any controlled quality conditions. That's just throwing a bunch of chemicals together that come from our famous friends, the Chinese, regardless of what they want to say.
No, 100%. Yep. And I'm not trying to go off topic, but I never knew this. And I went to a Wisconsin Narcotics Association. They had me speaking, and there was a guy that, I don't know if he was outsourced through DEA or something. He was like a scientist, and he talked about how the pills form and why they're so dangerous. And because I'll probably botch this, but basically, like, fentanyl sticks to fentanyl. If you have a bunch of molecules and you try to mix it up, that's why there's no medical pills that are fentanyl pills, because fentanyl clumps together. So you try to make pills where it's all proportioned the right way. It doesn't work that way. So that's why you have all these like pills that are no fentanyl or all fentanyl, because they clump together. And when he did the diagram and showed it, I was blown away. I was like, it makes sense now, but I never knew that until then.
I didn't know that either. But I do know a regular pill, you take the active ingredient and then they use binders to hold everything together. And that's what creates the pill.
Then the stuff that they're doing in Mexico is nothing like that. It's crazy.
No, it's so dangerous. And that's a whole nother topic itself there. Mm-hmm. So tell us, you come out, now you're out on the highway. I'm sure you get calls from other officers to come and search a car or search a residence or whatever. But are you out by yourself, or is there another patrol unit close by?
So there's a multi-unit team that we all work very close with. But again, that's not like the city stuff. There's a possibility you're working in a city and you have backup there in 30 seconds. The highway could be 30 seconds or it could be 30 minutes. So you got to be able to adapt to that. Coming from a city to go to a highway, and I'm used to having backup constantly there. Now, not always there, or just depends on the day, I guess. But yeah, like it was a learning curve for sure.
And so let's say you go out on the interstate, and are you just running up and down the highway looking at cars, or are you stationary? Tell
Both.
Us what you do.
I mean, sometimes I'll sit in the median and kind of watch for the human behavior and driver reaction, or depending on the highway, sometimes I'll cruise in the slow lane. I have an unmarked car, so as people are approaching, they don't necessarily know it's the police. And then I'm kind of watching them to watch those reactions as they realize that I'm the police, but either sitting in the median or kind of just doing laps around the highways.
Tell us about, it's funny you said that, the reactions once they realize you're a cop. What are some of those reactions?
I mean, sometimes they're not even criminal in nature. That you'll see people that are going 100 miles an hour, and I'm shocked that their brakes are that good at how fast they slow down and they don't flip over or something. But you'll see that, you're just cruising, and all of a sudden you see a car coming up to you, and you're like, they don't make it by you, and they were going every bit of 100 miles an hour until they saw you. So those are always funny to laugh at.
Yeah, if you can see their face, I'm sure they're going, crap, there's the man. What kind of vehicle are you driving?
Right now I drive an unmarked Durango.
Oh, nice. You got the nice Hemi engine and all that?
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I got a Dodge truck. It's got that Hemi. All that's paid for is getting you in trouble.
Yeah, Dodges are good, especially when it comes to the engine. Some of the other stuff that they do, not so much. But the engine, those Hemis are great.
Yeah. You see those Hellcats out there they got too, man. Those things, what they're supposed to get up to 190 miles an hour or something?
The county that I work in, the sheriff bought a few of those for his guys and a couple Trackhawks.
Oh, man.
They went down to someplace in Arizona to like learn how to drive them with a race car track. That's how fast they go.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay, so you're out there and you're either stationary or mobile, and you see, I know years ago they came out and said profiling was illegal. So you're looking for, I've heard law enforcement officers now talk about indicators.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes, I hate the word profiling because it always gets lumped into racial profiling, but cops are always profiling, but they're looking for the criminal profiling aspect of it. It doesn't matter your race, religion, sex, any of that stuff. None of that matters. Cops that are out there doing the job the right way for the right reasons are trained to go find criminals. That's what you want them to do. That's what society pays cops to do.
Right.
You just don't want us sitting around doing nothing and then you call us. You want us proactively finding criminals. So in order to do that, you have to understand the psychology and, you know, get the training and understanding of what a criminal is and what a criminal does. So that's kind of what I use an analogy often when I talk to people. If you're afraid of snakes or spiders and I throw one at you, you're not just going to sit there. If you're driving with a 20-year prison sentence in your trunk and you see a cop, you're not just going to be normal. You're going to react. Unless you're a complete like psycho or sociopath, like you have to react just the way we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing is we're trying to teach our listeners how to not get pulled over by the police here.
Again, psychology is going to take over. Like no matter what, I could tell you all day, hey, this is what we're looking for. No matter what, you have kilos in your trunk and you go buy a cop, I promise you that you're going to react. Whether you do it intentionally or unintentionally, like, you're going to have some reactions.
Yeah. And you know what? I mean, I've been retired now since 2013 from law enforcement, but I still, when especially on the highway and you see a police car, I'm like, oh, crap. The first thing you do is look down at your speedometer, see how fast you're going.
Exactly.
You know? And then you don't want to be disrespectful and pass him. And my wife and I were at a red light here a couple of months ago. And here in Orlando, let me tell you, the people live like this in their cars, looking at their phone. And they can be the first in line, and they will sit there through a whole red light signal unless you blow the horn at them. And so there's this little white SUV in front of us, and sure enough, you can tell the guy's looking down, and the light's been changed for at least 3 seconds, which is about the limit of my patience. And I laid on that horn, and he looked up and put his phone down, and he went and took off. And as he went around the curve, I could see Orange County Deputy Sheriff on the side. I'm like, am I going to get pulled over when I go around the curve?
That's awesome.
But even after all those years in law enforcement, you're right. I still have a psychological reaction when I see, especially a marked unit.
Yep.
I'm not the slowest driver in the world. I don't commit felonies, but those misdemeanors I'm pretty good with, driving misdemeanors. I shouldn't have a driver's license.
I think it's a cop thing. We always kind of, you know, used to driving fast and don't realize it when we're off duty.
Yeah, or when you retire either.
Yeah, or that.
So you see something that makes you suspicious, right? So I don't know. I've never done interdiction myself, not like you do. So what could that be? What are those indicators that you might see?
So, I mean, it all depends. Initially, I'm looking for a deviation or a change in your driving behavior. So typically, I'm going to see them before they see me. And maybe they're driving, like, I don't know, 85 miles an hour. They're nice and relaxed. And all of a sudden, I see a reduce in speed and they pull up and they're all rigid. I'm like, well, that's weird. Nothing else has changed in your environment. I get it that you're speeding, but that's still, you're adding other things. So you're not only reducing speed, but you're changing the position in of the way you're sitting in your car or whatever it is. And oftentimes what I would like to explain to people when they ask me, I like to see something that's comforting or concealing as people are approaching. So like maybe they're trying to push themselves behind the B pillar. Maybe they're trying to, like, I don't know, men with facial hair will play with their facial hair. It's subconscious that they're doing it, but unless you're driving the whole time playing with it, okay, that's fine. But now if it's a deviation and you weren't, you see me reduce speed, push behind the B pillar, start playing with your beard. I'm like, okay, there's a cluster of behaviors I just saw that piqued my interest.
All right. And so what's your probable cause to pull that car over? You got to have a reason.
Yeah. So like many times I see these behaviors, but they didn't commit any infraction. So if they don't commit an infraction, I'll do one of two things. Maybe I'll go up maybe 10 miles, sit in the median, maybe see them again. If I do, and they have commit infraction, cool. If not, then I only do it one time. I'm not going to keep chasing them and following them. And I'll call buddies in other states or down the road and be like, hey, man, this is what I saw. It might be worth something to look at. I couldn't get them stopped.
Got it. I mean, that's encouraging because our law enforcement professionals are not over there just randomly pulling cars over. Do you guys ever set up roadblocks?
No, I know some other states will set up like kind of the Rouge roadblock. Mm-hmm. Because drug checkpoints are illegal unless the checkpoints have to be either a lie or officer information, like you had a homicide or something and you're giving out flyers, but you can't do like the drug checkpoints. So what they'll do is, I know that some other states will put up signs that say checkpoint ahead, and then it's one exit before that where there's nothing besides like fields. And then all of a sudden it's the busiest exit in the world. So then all the cops are just sitting there and there's actually no checkpoint up the road because it's illegal.
But we
don't do any of that. But I love when I see them because I'm like, man, I wish we did those more often. Or I don't even know if we can in our state. I've never seen it done in our state, but I've seen other states.
I saw it in Florida and in Georgia both. I don't think I ever saw it in North Carolina though, but they were funny. No, there was. Because some of the cops I work with up in North Carolina used to talk about them. So I never participated in one, though. And so you've got PC now. And are you going to get out of the car with your dog?
No.
So you're going to go approach the driver. Do you go to the driver's side, passenger side, or does it depend on what your circumstances are?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, I'm trying to not get hit by cars going 70 miles an hour. So like most time, I mean, theoretically, people should pull to the right. But there's occasion people that pull to the left and now we're in the median. So I might go into the driver's side. But I try to avoid the traffic wherever. Mm-hmm. The opposite side of wherever traffic is. And I think where interdiction is different from most jobs in law enforcement is communication is huge. I have to build a rapport with you in 7 to 10 minutes. And I have to be able to calm that anxiety and stress from just being stopped to then gauge whether there's some criminal behavior in play. And oftentimes the way that I go about it is everything I downplay. I don't come off as this authoritative person. I'm very like laid back. If I stop someone that's my age, I'm talking to them like I talk to my friends. If it's someone that's elderly, it's ma'am and sir, like, but it's never like I'm this and who I am. Like, you can see that I'm a cop. I have a gun, a badge, and a vest. Like, I don't have to tell you and stand on that authoritative figure. Mm-hmm. I talk to him just like I would talk to like you, like no different. There's absolutely nothing different. And I'm trying to build this rapport because I want them to feel comfortable around me. And for me, when I stop someone on the highway, I explain right away, like, hey, this is what you did wrong. But as long as your license is good, I'm going to give you a warning. There'll be no court and no fine. A lot of fear of law enforcement is the fear of the unknown. Like if you're traveling from seven states away and you get a ticket and it's $300, you got to pay it or come back to court. Like you might have stress and anxiety over that. So I explain right from the get-go multiple times during a traffic stop that you're not going to have to fine. You're not going to have to come back to court. Nothing along those lines. It's strictly no court, no fine. And you'll be on your way. And if that stress and anxiety still is there during that traffic stop or gets higher, it's something that then I'm going to dig into a little bit more during that stop and ask more questions about travel plans and things along those lines.
If you've got multiple passengers in the car, how far into this do you get before you separate them?
Almost immediately. Initially, like I'll lay out the foundation of why I stopped you and get their information. And then I'll have them step out. And during the traffic stop, either most of the time we were kind of maybe outside my passenger side door and I'm, running their information and writing my warning or ticket, whatever it may be. And in that time, I'm just engaging them in the conversation, but it's almost, immediate. I don't leave the passenger side of their car unless they're coming with me pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause that's where you get the conflicting statements, which are just continuing to build your probable cause that something's not right. Like I've ever done it. I learned that from Cardwell.
Yeah, I was going to come on here and bust the DEA's balls about the only reason that they survive is from the interdiction guys giving you information. It's not the other way around.
There you go, buddy. There you go. It's all part of that big law enforcement community taking care of each other.
Exactly.
I remember with Cardwell, especially when I was in North Carolina, you're always out on the street working with cases and so forth. But maybe one day every week or every other week, you had to stay in the office all day and just catch up on paper. And it was amazing because Cardwell would call me and we didn't have cell phones back then. And he would catch me in the office or sometimes he even called me at home and he could call EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center, and get information. But if he could get a hold of me, I'd get on the computer and start running NATIS checks on who the people we had stopped and see if they've been involved in anything in the past and just helping him build the probable cause. And then I don't know if it's still the same because I've been gone so long, but I could go ahead and authorize the seizure, especially if it was cash. If it's an asset, then I could authorize the seizure. And the defense attorneys in North Carolina, we're talking about in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s. And defense attorneys eventually got wise to that. And so if somebody had cash seized off of them that they don't know how it got in their car, and it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you got conflicting stories where the driver says, we're going here, and the pastor says, we're going there, and who are you going to see? And they don't have a clue, and they just don't have their stories together. The defense attorneys would go to a state judge, have them issue an order to the trooper to give the cash back to the owner until you've had an opportunity to further investigate the suspicious circumstances. Well, as a Fed, I don't have to abide by what a state judge says. So I'd authorize a seizure. If he'd seize the cash, and it was the guys on his team also, they had a team out there. They'd go straight to a bank, get that cash converted over to a cashier's check made out to the U.S. Marshals. And if I wasn't working, I mean, there's been times when they come to my house and drop off the check. But then the defense attorney shows up at that quarter, give us the money back. Can't, already turned it over to the feds. You'll have to go talk to them. Then these attorneys think they can bully you to start with till they get to know you. I've got a state court order here from a judge that says you got to give that back. Okay. Did you say state? Because no, I don't. Okay.
It's a little different now. But the my federal partners or our TFOs over there, they are a lifeline. When like I'm getting ready to search a car, I'll send the information and see if there's anything derogatory on their end that I don't have access to. But when it comes to asset forfeiture, they have to come to the scene and seize it from there. They have to be there.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's just a rule in my area, but yeah. Ever since I've been doing this, that's pretty much been the rule.
Well, I remember DOJ had really tightened down on the on the guidelines to make asset seizures, and not to go political, but they were just trying to get away from it, quite be quite honest with you. Well, I mean, who carries around hundreds of thousands of dollars in their car? And then when you ask where it came from, I don't know. Not mine.
Or it's not even their car, and they're in compartments, and they're like, oh, I don't know there's a compartment there, and it's loaded with money. Like, what money? And like, all these things. So it's a third-party car. There's an aftermarket compartment, and they have no idea. But yeah, I don't know why the DOJ was trying to hamper that, because I feel like if you're seizing, that's where you hit them the hardest. All this work and effort. Yeah, the dope is in the country now, but all that work and effort, this is their reward.
Yep.
The dope is really cheap when they get it. It's only once it gets here that it puts so much value on it. So now you take that money away. That's where you're hitting them the hardest, I feel, anyways.
Absolutely. I like to say that if you want to hurt somebody, you put them in jail. If you want to make them cry, take their stuff. Because that's what it's all about. They don't care about you. They don't care about any human life other than themselves and whoever they're working for. Because they know if they don't do right, they'll get killed.
Yep.
So, okay. So now you've got PC to search a car. How often do you ask to search a car and people say yes?
I don't want to jinx myself, but it's fairly often.
Isn't it crazy?
Surprisingly often. Yeah. And my first 2 years, my agency didn't have cameras, and I begged and pleaded for them because I'm like, guys, you would not believe how many people just say yeah. And not even a compartment, it's sitting on the back seat in a duffel bag. And I need a camera because I would be leery if I was a jury. And you're telling me he said yeah? I promise. Like, I wouldn't make this shit up. But for, you know, those first couple of years, we would have a written consent. So at least I had a signature. But on cameras, you get to see the whole thing unfold as a juror. And I was like, I need it. So finally, in 2014, they gave me a camera. So thank God.
Yeah. I had an attorney in Miami, an assistant U.S. attorney down there in Southern District of Florida, tell me one time the best, and it hurt my feelings, to be honest with you, because I, you know, my ego. He said, the best evidence you can bring me is video. Second best is audio. Third best is an agent's testimony. Like, well, damn, thanks.
Well, but I mean, I mean, especially with that, everyone thinking like everything's recorded and just the movies and the TV shows and everyone has body cams. And yeah, I think a jury almost expects it now these days.
Yeah. When they tell you no, then what's your course of action at that point? You cannot search my car.
As long as I have reasonable suspicion at that point, then I can deploy the dog. And if the dog alerts, then it gives me probable cause. If the dog doesn't alert, then you won and you're on your way. There's nothing else I'm doing at that point. And there's many other crimes that we come across, like credit card fraud, retail theft, like all these things that there's a possibility. You know, my dog's not alerting to credit cards. So if that's the avenue and maybe I did have reasonable suspicion, my dog doesn't alert, you didn't give me consent, you're kind of on your way at that point.
When you say you deploy the dog, how does that go? You just pull the dog out of the car and say, go get it?
I mean,
I know you don't, but I'm being facetious again.
When it comes to Gibby, yeah, that dude's ready to go all the time. Typically, like we'll pull him out, let him go to the bathroom, kind of acclimate around the area, and then
this is on leash, right?
She is, yes, on leash. Sorry, and then once he kind of goes to his bathroom and gets everything out of his system, then we'll position the dog usually downwind, whatever that may be, to give him a better opportunity to smell, and then deploy them on the car. Just give them a command to search.
Do you have a lot of people challenge you once you bring the dog out? Like they're standing, you don't leave them in the car. Do you get them out of the car while the dog searches?
I guess it just all depends. Weather permitting, things along those lines. Sometimes people are less mobile, elderly. I don't want people passing out. So there's a multitude of factors. But if I do leave them in my car, there's nothing readily available. My car also has automatic start. And when I get out, I automatic start. So if they were to try to steal it or whatever, and the key fob's not in it, they couldn't go anywhere. So it just kind of depends. Environmental things come into play a lot there.
Do you have a lot of people like, what's that dog doing? Don't let that dog scratch my car. Don't do this. Don't do that.
Not really. No.
No.
I guess I'm also dealing with a different clientele. If I'm looking at a smuggler aspect of it, maybe they don't even own the car. So those types of things I've noticed more if you're dealing with someone that is a lower level, maybe an ounce kind of guy in a city environment. I see more of that on that avenue instead of the smuggler that just has a bad moral compass in hauling a commodity that he doesn't have a vested interest in, or she doesn't.
And that kind of goes back to something that I always saw in my career. It seemed like the smaller the dealer, or you know, grams or ounces, the more potential for violence. Because the big guys that have 1,000 kilos, believe it or not, it was really rare that they would resist at all.
Yeah, I think they look at it as a different business, man. Like When you're dealing with a lower level dealer, like that's his entire livelihood. You know what I'm saying? Typically, they're going to carry their drugs, maybe their gun and their money, all of it together on them. And if they go to jail, not only are they going to jail, but they're losing everything at that point in their own mind. They're losing everything.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with a mule, that's not his drugs. He doesn't necessarily have a vested interest in it. He has a vested interest to get paid or to the organization, but that's not his. So if he loses it all, he's not out everything. He might go to jail. He might owe the organization, but he's not out like my livelihood at this moment.
That's a great way to describe it too. How does Gibby alert if she sniffs something?
Gibby's a he, but
I'm sorry.
Take away his man card like that.
No, sorry. Sorry, Gibby.
It's a passive alert. So it's either going to be a sit, lay down. If it's something that's lower in odor, Gibby will crawl under the car. And depending on heat and stuff, I don't let him keep crawling because I don't want him to get hurt. But if he starts to go underneath the car, he's trained to go to source. So that's his alert. So it's a passive alert. It's either sit, lay down, maybe lock an odor point, depending on maybe higher odors or things like that. But it's a passive alert.
And then what's your next action?
Usually I go and I inform the occupants, hey, this is what happened. This is what's going on. I don't leave them in the dark. I want them to be aware of what's taking place so they're not the unknown. Again, the fear of the unknown, people make irrational decisions when they don't know what's going on. So I explain everything in detail. I have no reason at that point not to. I would prefer people know exactly the law, what they can and can't do, everyone, because then it makes our job easier. If you know what cops can and can't do, then you don't have all these, I guess, ideas of what it is. Like if you know the reason I'm searching because my dog alerted and it gives me probable cause, I think it kind of, you might not necessarily like it, but you know the law now.
Mm-hmm. If your dog alerts, are you going to call another unit to come out and back up?
Hopefully there's another unit by there. But yeah, usually once that process is taking place, I've already called for someone.
Got it. Well, and we can pretty much figure out after that, you know, you find something that's illegal or unexplainable, there's action going to be taken.
Yeah.
What is the most unusual compartment that you or your dog have ever found? I mean, you've heard about the hydraulic compartments. I encounter a lot with DEA. But.
Yeah, seen those. I'm just trying to think of one that's like super unique or different.
Or what's typical also?
Yeah, I mean, that's typically what we see. I guess some of the unique ones, and this is where some of my friends in the profession have really helped me out because again, I started in 2012. I didn't hit a roof compartment in a car until 2023. And because I'm very small minded, I'm very like, oh, they're not going to be here. Like I'm an idiot. And most cops, when they search cars, they look down. Yeah. And my buddy in San Diego, his name is Jeremy Bedingfield. He teaches an amazing trap course. And he was like, dude, there's roof compartments by you. I'm like, no, there's not. They're not by me. He's like, I'm telling you. So I'm on the phone for a month with him, like picking his brain, being this annoying little person, trying to learn. And then in back-to-back days in March, I hit roof compartments in 2023. And I'm like, all right, you're right, Jeremy. I was wrong. So I always talk about those because as cops, when we search cars, we always look down. It's very rare that we look up. Very, very rare.
What is a roof compartment? I don't even know what that is in a car, a truck?
Yeah, no, roof. I mean, anything, I guess. Both of mine were SUVs. And basically, they either remove the roof from the outside, take the shell completely off, and build some type of, the first one was like sheet metal. And then the other one had built like a tray that was a levitating tray inside. So if you hit it, you wouldn't hear it. The one that was sheet metal was like a brick. So I was like, all right, that one's messed up. But yeah, so basically they just built a box within the roof.
Pretty ingenious.
Yeah, I'm sure that I've missed many more that I don't even know about and I don't want to tell Jeremy about, but yeah.
Jerry Free, if you're listening, call me, brother. We'll talk. I'll get some information offline. Tell us about the most dangerous interdiction stop you've had.
So I've had two. I always tell this one in my class, but I'll give you the short version. Basically, I stopped these two dudes. They're a third-party rental car. They're not making any sense. I didn't have a dog at the time. Trooper shows up, runs his dog. Alert, we find 2 pounds of weed and a gun. Arrest them. And again, like my department is a great department, and it's like old school sports. We always bust each other's balls, no matter if you do a good job or not. So I go home. I come back the next day, and the sergeant's sitting there. He's like, good job yesterday. And I'm like, okay, here we go. 2 pounds of weed and a gun. Like, we're going to bust my balls. Here we go. Mm-hmm. And he's like, what, you don't know? And I was like, I have no clue what you're talking about. And he's like, last night, there was a be on the lookout for that car because it was involved in a multiple homicide. So before the be on the lookout came out, we had one of the murder weapons in the car too. So it was, but at the time looking at it, you would have never, me personally, human behavior is something that I pride myself on. And I knew that they were lying and not telling the truth. And there were some behaviors that I was paying attention to, but it wasn't something so egregious that I would thought that's what it was. The one that still gives me like stress and anxiety, very similar situation. Stop it. It's a father, son, and not making any sense. They tinted the windows in this rental car themselves, and I was asking him why the dad wasn't making any sense. I run son, and he pops up as he's wanted for homicide out of Georgia. And I'm by myself at the time, so I literally just back my car up as much as possible. Dad's being cooperative with me. But that one was still like a very stressful situation until my backup arrived, because I couldn't see the kid in the car, wanted for homicide, windows are tinted, like ungodly. And so that one I still think about, and I'm like, man, that's things could have went bad there. They didn't have any weapons on him or anything that time, but just the unknown. Again, that stress and anxiety from the unknown.
Yeah, he could have had a long gun pointed at you from inside that car, and you wouldn't even know it.
Yep.
Was the dad in your car with you?
Mm-hmm.
What did he say when you started backing up?
I told him. I was very honest. I think I was able to get handcuffs on him in front, but it was some security. And then I just told him, like, yo, this was going on. And I backed up, and dad started to cry and stuff. And I think that their plan was to kind of get son away from there, knew that he had this warrant, and taking him to family up in Wisconsin.
Ooh, that's when those things are over, you say, thank you, Lord.
Yes. Yeah. Those both of those, at least with the first one, I had a trooper with me pretty quickly, you know, within the first minute or two, he was already there, because we were kind of working in the same area. I didn't have a dog. He did. And makes you feel a little more comfortable when the odds are even, I guess.
Absolutely.
If something bad was to happen.
Do you guys have common radio frequencies? Wow. See, that's how things have progressed over the years.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's amazing is even now our portables, they work. I don't know what kind of radios you guys have, but they work off 800. They work off Wi-Fi and they work off cell. So there's not a lot of dead spots anywhere.
Wow. No, that I remember when 800 was first coming out. That was the 800 megahertz. We're good to go now, guys.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I remember when I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but I think it was in Georgia the first time, in Atlanta, and the Nextels came out, the push to talk, and you could talk to somebody from Atlanta, you could talk to somebody from Savannah, and we were just like, oh, God, how's that? It's magic. You
know? I remember those, but I was not a cop at the time that those came out.
That and Blackberries. Wow, yep. Blackberries, that was the greatest thing since sliced bread, right?
Yep.
And now look where we are.
It's crazy.
Everything's encrypted. What is the most, I know that was the most dangerous cases that you mentioned there just now, but what's the most memorable case? The one that I guess maybe you're the proudest of throughout your career. One that if you're sitting at the bar with the guys and telling war stories that they're going to want to hear, something you're really proud of.
There's a couple, I still remember like everything. There's a couple attorneys that I stopped that were trafficking. And those are the ones that I like because
they were attorneys.
Well, yeah, but I mean, very intelligent people. They're portraying this image, but their story still doesn't make sense. Like if you're an attorney in New York and you went to California, but you can't explain why. Like it doesn't. I don't care that you're an attorney. So they're trying to play that attorney card, lexing like, oh, I'm an attorney, leave me alone, kind of stuff. But like it doesn't work when your story still doesn't make sense of why you flew to California and you're driving back cross country for no reason. And like, the older guy got, he was like 76 or 77. He was an attorney and he was wearing a collared shirt, a tie, and like a sweater vest over it. Yeah, it just doesn't seem conducive to drive across country like that. But yeah. Again, he was trying to portray that image. So those are two that I always like. just because like, and I'm like, what kind of attorney are you that you can't, like, attorneys make good money. Like you either got to be a shit attorney or you got some type of habits that I don't even want to know about, because how the hell are you not making a living being an attorney?
Yeah. And why are you not flying?
Well, that too.
Wow. And what cop in the world doesn't like putting an attorney in jail? I'll be able to facetious again, y'all. I like attorneys. Okay.
Yeah, I love attorneys besides the ones that are running drugs.
Yeah. They tick us off, but they're doing their jobs. I mean, that's our legal system. It is what it is. It's the best in the world, whether you like it or not.
Yeah. And I feel like attorneys, most of the time, if you show them respect, and this kind of goes both ways, they're trying to more get you off on like maybe legalities or formalities and things like that, not necessarily calling your integrity in question. And I feel like cops, often we go down that, like, you're questioning my integrity. I'm like, we're just questioning your understanding of case law, because there's a big difference in those.
No, you're absolutely right. That's the only time I ever got mad at a federal public defender, but they dismissed the jury so they could ask me a question outside of the jury. And so I answered it for the judge. And then they brought the jury back in, asked me a question. I answered the same way. And it's like all hell broke loose in the courtroom. And they're pointing their finger at me. And then we break for lunch. And I'm just fuming because I'm just like you said, I felt like my integrity had been challenged. And the AUSA comes up and he said, "Hey, Murph, let's go get some lunch." I'm like, "Great." And the public defender comes over and he says, "You guys mind if I go to lunch with you?" "Damn right I mind if you go to lunch with me. I'm not going to ever talk to you again." Had a few choice words. He's like, "What's wrong with you, Murphy?" I'm like, "You just questioned my integrity after you knew how I was going to answer the question." He's like, "Man, it's part of the game. It's nothing personal here." And I said, "Well, today it is." And then I finally grew up a little bit and I got over it. I had my little pity party.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like a lot of times I see cop or attorneys off duty that I thought, wait a minute, you know, this sometimes that's how they come across. And then they're the nicest people in the world. It's almost like not a show, but I mean, kind of. You have to have some charisma and you have to deliver things and you have to be like, I don't know.
That's their job, is to cast the shadow of a doubt.
Yep, that's it.
Some of them are good at it and some of them are just sleazy at it.
Agreed.
So in all your experience now, how have you seen trends changing? Like, what are you seeing the latest trend as far as transporting drugs in vehicles? I've heard stories that people will hire old couples to drive RVs across, and that was back in the weed days. And I even had, there's one guy that I met at the Southern California Gang Conference one year he was a former bad guy with the Arellano Felix organization out of Tijuana, the Mexican cartel. And he was gringo, and they would study the habits of police officers in California. And apparently, and I never heard this, in 38 years as a cop and I was already retired when I was going to these conferences. Apparently, if you're out there and a marked unit goes to pull you over and you're law enforcement, they would hang their hand out the window and they would put four fingers down. And that was to represent code 4, which is your disregard in police lingo. And that was an unofficial sign that, hey, I'm a cop. And most time they'd let you go because who knows what that means? Four fingers.
Wow.
Down. But so they would do that and they would grow their porn star mustaches because a lot of cops had those. And your hair, you still got hair, but you got most of it shaved off where I just don't have much hair left.
I'm losing some of it too.
But we kind of emulate what cops look like. And he said it was shocking how many times they got out of getting pulled over because of things like that. So I'm just curious, what things do you see now as far as the interdiction business? What's the latest trends?
I mean, the military thing, I think they play on that a lot, like where guys will be in military uniforms or have military things. The business aspect, like where they have suits hanging up, like they're traveling for business, I think is very common for me anyways. And I think those trends might be different around the country, but they try to emulate whatever that traffic is in your area, I feel like. So if you're working South Texas, you might see like oil trucks and shit that works in the oil field doing the same thing. But you bring that up by me, that would stand out like a sore thumb. Like, it doesn't make sense. We don't have that type of stuff. I think that, you know, ultimately their whole game is to blend in with whatever local traffic or whatever traffic patterns you're seeing in your particular area. A lot of business, a lot of military I see. As far as current trends recently seen, and I don't know like how widespread this is, but my last seizure was a liter water bottles that were filled with ketamine. And they're pretty cooperative with me, the individuals. It was a husband wife combo, and that's something that I have never seen before. Like, we've seen like the meth solutions and things like that, and but this was something different. And where it's the ketamine's in big liter water bottles, and what stood out to me was there was just powder and they were all cracked. Why do you have 9 bottles of liter water bottles? It didn't make sense for two people to have these that are all opened. You can see that the seal's broken. Some of them had powder on them, but I think that's one of the most current trends that I'm seeing right now. I've never seen ketamine in my life until that seizure either. So I don't know if ketamine's me. I have no idea what it is, but that's the most recent that I could think of.
Yeah, I think it's another drug like fentanyl that actually has a legitimate medical purpose, but also used in excess is considered illegal, if that makes sense. And I don't want to go, I try to stay very apolitical on the show here, but I mean, we all know we have a new president and his administration and the way he's controlling the border. Have you seen a reduction in drugs moving across the highway since the new administration come in? Or is it still the same or is it worse?
For me personally, the trafficking aspect of narcotics seems to be slower right now. But what we did see, we saw a lot of human traffickers under the last administration, especially towards the end. And I don't know if it was like a mad push because they knew that Trump was. Oh, so back in the day, let's say when I first started before the past 5 years or whatever, I would see maybe one a month at most. And then maybe towards the past three or four years, it was like one a day. And I'm far away from the border. So it was very strange. And then now it's like I haven't seen one in months. So the human aspect of it, yeah. So I think that that's definitely curtailed. And the narcotics has slowed down as far as trafficking goes. The only time that I've seen it completely stop was during COVID, where it was anything, and drug prices went through the roof, and people moving things on different routes in smaller amounts, like maybe a kilo from Washington State all the way to New York. And I just felt like it wasn't coming across the border as frequent because the borders were shut down.
Well, you're in an extremely target-rich environment because you're so close to Chicago. Chicago is one of the primary transshipment points for drugs coming in from Mexico. Chicago and Atlanta are the two primary transshipment points. If you were king for a day, any thoughts on how to curb illegal drugs coming across the border into our country?
I don't like that argument because I think that the demand argument doesn't supply the sensation. If you want to be an addict, there's other avenues. Like you could be addicted to pills and all these other things. So I don't buy that argument at all that it's a problem that we have to focus on here. I think the problem is them getting here and how readily available they are. So I think in order to actually stop narcotics from getting in this country, you have to go to the origin places. So you're going to have to go to like the jungles of Peru and Colombia and stuff like that to get rid of the coke. You got to go to China and make them stop pushing. And that would be my biggest thing. Like, you got to get the fentanyl stopped. Like, you have to do something with that. And that those precursors are coming from China, whether you want to believe it or not. They're setting up labs. They have Chinese scientists that are setting up labs in Mexico. I don't know. If you want to deny that all you want, I don't know what to tell you, but it's happening. And that's the biggest problem. Cocaine is a problem. Meth is a problem. All of it. But fentanyl is killing 100,000+ people in this country a year. And it's absolutely ridiculous that we have not taken a stronger stance against it.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% there. People, when they interview my old partner, Javier, and I, they talk about, did we really have a positive effect on drug trafficking when Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel were taken down, and what our opinion is on the war on drugs? Has it been successful? First of all, the term war on drugs is the biggest misnomer the government's ever come up with. Because we're going after the person who's responsible for manufacturing and distributing 80% of the world's cocaine. What'd we send? Two guys.
It's a hell of a war.
It's a joke. Yeah, I mean, you had resources to support you, but still, it's never been a true war. Mm-mm. And you mentioned the overdose rates here in the United States. It looks like there might have been a reduction in 24, but we're still... If we're not at 100,000 or over 100,000, it's still going to be close. It's not a major reduction. But you look at how many Americans in our own country are dying every day, and our people that are watching are supposed to be coming up with solutions. Most of them didn't even know it was a problem until the last year or two.
It's funny. It's funny you speak of that. I feel like in addiction, we see things and trends way before other people. Maybe 2015, 2016, we were coming across a lot of Chinese with tons of money. And my local guys were like, oh, we don't know about Chinese involved in the drug game. And I was like, you guys better get some information about it. Cause well, I don't know how you don't have any. That was like 10+ years ago, but now you watch it all unfold and now it's becoming national news that, you know, these Chinese nationals are the main pushers of the black market marijuana in the country and all that funding's, you know, eventually getting back to China. And then even recently, like the South American Theft Group guys, like we're seeing them on the highway on a regular basis. And I'm like, and then we started to get bulletins and started to ask around the country and other local departments were seeing that. And then you don't make national news until you break into Patrick Mahomes' house. But they've been here for 5-6 years at this point. Like, why, these things are problems. And I feel at some point people don't want to listen to the locals. And interdiction specifically, we're seeing those things firsthand and probably at a quicker and sooner rate than most departments, and especially on the federal level, I feel like.
Yeah. Yep. Well, so in addition to all the other things that you've been involved with, your activities have been recognized because I found a list of honors and awards that there's like 20 different things on here.
It's all luck.
Listen, I don't want to hear that crap. But there's actually two things on here that really caught my attention. And let's see, the first one was they're both sniff-off champions. What the heck is a sniff-off championship?
So those are for my dogs. And what that is basically, depending on how many people, but it's usually between 30 and 70 different dog teams. And they put a certain number of narcotics out. It's almost like the canine Olympics types for the nose. And if you find them the fastest, you know, you place in those. And if you make a bad call, it adds time to you. So you can't just go in there and just like start, tier here, tier. No, every bad call adds a minute to your time. And some of those times, I don't know how many hides, maybe say six hides. Sometimes the overall time's between a minute and 2 minutes. So if you have one bad call, you're kind of screwed. You're not going to win. So those I'm proud of because those are my dogs. So we could talk about those all day.
Yeah, it looks like, did you win the championship in 2018? Looks like.
Yeah, I think I have a first and a third with Mojo, and then I have a third with Gibby.
Excellent. And then there's a lot of interdiction team of the year awards. I see one here from, is Desert Snow, is that thing still going?
Yeah, it's still going strong.
Yeah, so in my way of describing it, it's a group of interdiction officers around the country that get together and exchange notes and learn from each other and share information. And I think it's online, right?
Yeah, you have to be vetted through as law enforcement.
Yeah,
to get in.
That's pretty cool, man. You got a sniff award. I mean, Gibby got a sniff
award. Gibby and Mojo. But yeah, I'll take credit for some of those.
And tell us a little bit about your podcast, Beyond the Barrel.
Yeah, so Beyond the Barrel, it's like a double pun, Beyond the Barrel of the Gun. And I was a bartender before I was a cop and kind of like going back to my old roots of Beyond the Bourbon Barrel type thing. So after work, having some drinks and kind of BS with first responders and their families and things along those lines. I enjoy the podcast because I get these opportunities to talk to cops. And oftentimes as cops, you might get to sit down and talk to someone for 10 minutes at most. You don't have a lot of like one-on-one. And at least now in the podcast, I get to trap them there for an hour and find out more about them. With that, we're trying to put some things out there. With interdiction wise, there's a lot of legendary interdiction guys that are retired or in different avenues right now. All the ones that I've talked to said, basically they live vicariously through the guys and girls out there doing it. And they're always there to answer questions, but no one reaches out. On the other end of that, for me, I look at these guys and I put them on such a pedestal. Like, I'm not calling you. That's intimidating to me to call you and run things by you in scenarios. But all of them have said that their phone's always on. They're always willing to help. Plus, they put a lot of good knowledge out there in their trials and tribulations. So that little mini series that I'm doing there with Interdiction, I absolutely love it.
And you have a guest on every show just like this one. And how often does your show come out? Is it weekly?
We've been trying to do weekly. I guarantee you two a month for sure, but we do it differently. I don't put out Monday, Tuesday. It's the 1st, the 8th, the 15th, 22nd. So and whatever day of the week that falls on, that's the day that comes out.
Got it. The where can people find you? Are you on YouTube also?
Yeah, YouTube, Spotify, Apple for the podcast.
Very good. I mean, folks, give him a chance here. You started this in, I think, August of last year. Is that right?
Yeah, in the first couple of months, I was only doing one a month because it was maybe a little bit over my head. And now as I'm like learning the avenues and stuff, it makes it a little bit easier to put a little more out.
Well, in our conversations offline there, I think you're way ahead of me on the technology side. I never was a tech guy. What else you got? The Justice Academy training. What is that?
Me and my business partner, he's an attorney and a cop. We started that. He talks about case law, travels the country, and then I talk about interdiction. And then we have a female officer that's out of New Jersey. Her name's Heather Gloglich. She teaches a female class, which is not hate the man female class, but it's more of what females are expected to do in the job. Some case law about pregnancy, the federal standard when it comes to pregnancy and those types of things. So giving you more information as a female cop. And then she teaches a leadership class because she's a, I hope this is right. She's at least a captain. She might be something more, but she's got some rank and she's just an amazing person. She has an amazing story too.
So you go out, people hire you and you go out to their agencies or is it virtual or how do you do that?
Yeah, there's no cost to the agency. Basically, what we do is we have a price for our classes. If you want to host us, you bring us out. And for every 10 people that sign up and pay, your agency gets a free spot. Depending on travel and stuff like that, our minimums are kind of around the 30-person mark, unless it's something that we can drive. But there's a business aspect to it, but I try to make it as reasonable as possible. I don't work any other side jobs. I teach once a month. It takes 3 days. As cops, we don't make that good of money. And there has to be something there to make it kind of profitable just to make it make sense.
Right. And there's where that teaching side of you came in. Could get away with it.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting how life goes full circle like that.
It is. But you know what? You've got the experience in a specialized niche now that you can taint, especially in interdiction. That's great. Any other things that you're doing on the side?
No, that's it, I think, right? Yeah, just teaching. The Counterculture Network with a bunch of first responder podcasts is pretty amazing. Try to hang out with them. They do a live like every Friday night, so I try to get with them. That's more of a like a roll call type thing, you know? It's like all of us kind of just making fun of each other and stuff. There's not much else going on besides us like talking smack. But it's
Brent and Tyler had me on their Thursday Night Live YouTube live here a few weeks ago, and what a hoot.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's entertaining.
My wife, she watched about half of it. She's like, you guys are like a bunch of juveniles in high school. I said, yeah, but we had cigars. And before we let you go here, what, if any words of wisdom or advice that you might have for anybody out there, especially those that are considering a career in law enforcement?
Interdiction is the best niche that you could have when it comes to law enforcement. That's just my personal opinion. And I think that as cops, you get in the profession, understand and how to communicate. And communication is not only talking. I get more by just sitting and listening to people. Beyond what you guys see, I'm very introverted. This takes a lot out of me. So I can sit and I ask one question and I just listen to people respond. And as cops, what oftentimes I feel like we do is we're waiting to respond to someone talking instead of just sitting and listening and watching. And communication is going to take you a lot further in your career than a lot of other things that you think that you need or will need. If you can talk yourselves in and out of a lot of situations, it's going to make that profession a lot easier. And I absolutely love interdiction. You're using your best ability in 7 to 10 minutes, and you're trying to beat someone at a mental game that is prepared for weeks, months, or years to beat you. So, of course, I want big things in cars, but if I beat you in a mental game, it's a win for me, and that's what keeps me motivated. So you got to find out what motivates you, too. So I think communication, motivation, and it's got to be personal motivation. You can't have someone, your sergeant, your lieutenant, like the rah-rah at roll call. It's got to be something internal. But communication, motivation, and get into interdiction because I don't want it to die.
There you go. And it kind of turns out being a game when you're trying to match wits with somebody else, which is why we call this the Game of Crimes podcast, right?
Love it. Love that.
Yeah. Little cheesy thing there.
Yeah, I love it.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to close out here. Before we go, though, here's where you can find Kenny. His podcast is called Beyond the Barrel Podcast. Please go check it out. Look at it on YouTube. Subscribe to it. Give him a like. Download some episodes. Help him grow his audience here. He's relatively new in the podcast business. On YouTube, you can find him at Beyond the Barrel Podcast. On Instagram, found red_ninja111.
Yes, sir.
What's the red ninja thing?
So, quick story. Back in the day, my first email ever was K the Red Ninja. And the reason is me and my buddies used to mess with nunchucks, and I had red hair. So, it just... And then when I started to go out in like this education realm, I didn't want to give my department email. So I gave them the only other email I had, which was that. And then people started to pick up on it. And that story came out and I just ran with it.
Cool. Very cool. You could have put Ginger on there.
Could have.
On Facebook, look at Kenny Williams. On TikTok is red_ninja_111. LinkedIn is Kenny W. And his website for his training academy is justiceacademytraining.com. If you're looking for some training in interdiction or leadership, there's a lot to choose from out there. It's really unbelievable how much there is to choose from. But you want somebody that has experience and knows what they're talking about and not somebody that's never been there and done that. You just heard his story. I mean, if I wanted to learn about interdiction, I'm calling Kenny here and his friends there and their company. But Kenny, thank you so much, brother, for being on the show. It's an honor to have you on here. I want to thank you for your service and your continued service to your community, your willingness to get the word out there to help other law enforcement professionals learn from your experiences, being transparent about your activities and the dangers that you face and just some of the cool things that you've gotten to encounter that a lot of cops will never see in their careers. If there's anything that I can ever do for you or the Game of Crimes can do, you know how to get a hold of me, brother. And my opinion is, just because I retired does not mean that my oath ever expired. So whatever I can do to help law enforcement, I will continue to do. I think that's going to do it for this week, ladies and gentlemen. So thank you so much for continuing to join us here. Thank you for coming back and listening to me pontificate and get on my little high horse every once in a while about little pet peeves that are important to me. I appreciate your support. If you haven't gone over to YouTube yet, subscribed, go over to YouTube, chime in Game of Crimes podcast, hit that subscribe button, download some episodes, hit the like button. And I always love hearing your comments, good or bad. Some of the comments I get, they're mostly good, but occasionally there's little shit birds out there that'll send me nasty ones here. That's okay too, because I delete you. But I can't tell you how much I do appreciate you continuing to come back. But we all know why you come back every week. It's because you want to come to play the biggest, baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the Game of Crimes. Kenny, brother, be safe out there. Take care of yourself. Everybody else, God bless. I'll see you next week.
Thank you.